Welcome, everyone. Maybe some folks here for the first time. Welcome to all. This year at the Zen Center, we're taking up the practice theme of devotion. And we just started a class series on the three treasures, Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha, which we might say is like the heart of devotion in Buddha's way. If we're devoted to something, Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha is the center of it. The three treasures, we call them, sometimes the three refuges, that to which we go to for refuge, safety, security. These are meanings of refuge. The dictionary, the English dictionary, defines refuge as shelter or protection from danger or distress, something to which one has recourse to in difficulty. And I think that's a perfect translation for this ancient teaching of the Buddha, sharana or saranam, refuge. We place our security, trust, and all our energy, really, in the Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha. This is the ideal, because usually we're taking refuge, we're going for security to so many other things. Even as practitioners, aren't we constantly looking for safety and security in things, objects, retirement accounts, insurance for home, life, car, everything, relationships, entertainment? Maybe it's not a supreme refuge, but we go to it as a place of security and safety, something familiar. Convenience. I think in our modern culture, we take refuge in convenience and ease. Or we might say comfort. We take refuge in convenience and comfort. And none of these things are bad. There's nothing wrong with any of these things. But if we look to them as sources of true security and safety, we find, and I think we all know already really, that they don't stand up. They're all impermanent and falling apart. And they offer some security and safety and assurance for a little while, which is why we take refuge in them. But they're not truly reliable. We might say, well, Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha, that's kind of like abstract. Do we really, how can we turn all our attention towards refuge in these three treasures? So that's the proposal of the Buddha, so we can explore this a little bit, what this means, the three, taking refuge in Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha. For those who come to service, when we chant the sutras here, at the end of sutra chanting, we dedicate the merit of offering incense and flowers and light and our wholehearted unified chanting. All of that creates this kind of positive energy, and then we with our intention, we send it off to the Buddhas or all beings or those in need of well-being. And after we dedicate that merit, we kind of seal it with this refuge in the three treasures. We say all Buddha's 10 directions 3 times. It's the Buddha treasure. All honored ones, Bodhisattva, Mahasattvas. That's the Sangha treasure. Wisdom beyond wisdom, Maha Prajnaparamita, is the Dharma treasure. So it's like we're just taking refuge after this activity, and we could also say it's like the ultimate refuge, the ultimate three treasures. We're kind of cracking open any sense of this dedication of merit being like me sending some wholesome energy to you over there. It's kind of like dualistic. Maybe we could see it at the end of this dedication, we crack open that duality by invoking and taking refuge in these ultimate three treasures. All Buddha's 10 directions 3 times. Which is another way of translating that is all Buddhas, all awakened ones throughout space and time. So Buddhas, awakened ones, are not limited by space or time. But the old way of saying that is 10 directions. It means like north, south, east, west, and northeast, southeast, and northwest, southwest. That's 8. And then up and down makes 10. So throughout space is a simpler way of saying 10 directions, and 3 times are past, present, and future. Throughout all time and all space, these limited human constructs of space and time, Buddhas permeate throughout all of it. So Dogen Zenji, our ancient Japanese Zen founder, has an essay called The 10 Directions, Jippo in Japanese, where just to warm up to this sense of all Buddha's 10 directions 3 times, this is Dogen's expression about 10 directions. He says, the 10 directions enter one direction and enter one Buddha. So we might have a sense that there's millions of Buddhas throughout these 10 directions, but really in infinite space like this, if there are infinite Buddhas throughout the 10 directions, they all enter one direction called right here, and one Buddha. It's kind of going beyond one and many, going beyond all space. The 10 directions enter one direction and enter one Buddha. This being so, the 10 directions appear in the 10 directions. Because the 10 directions are one direction, this direction, self direction, it's the direction of this self, present direction, eyeball direction. So all inclusive. And it has something to do with this one that includes the 10 directions. Another Zen ancestor said, the entire universe in the 10 directions is the true human body. So this is like the self direction that all 10 directions enter. Dogen says, the 10 direction Buddhas in the 10 directions, in the 10 direction land, are neither large nor small, neither pure nor defiled. So this is the kind of Buddhas in 10 directions and 3 times that we take refuge in. Not like some little people floating around in the sky, sitting under trees. but actually awakened awareness itself that is not limited by any space or time by its very nature. We could almost even define Buddha as 10 directions, 3 times. Buddha awareness that has no location, boundaries, center, or graspable characteristics. So we take refuge in this Buddha as a supreme place of security and safety, because actually it's not impermanent. It's not fading away and unreliable like basically everything else we can think of. It's the one reliable source, along with Dharma. So Dharma, in this verse that we recite, is wisdom beyond wisdom, Mahaprajnaparamita. Mahaprajnaparamita means great wisdom beyond wisdom. So we recite the Wisdom Beyond Wisdom Heart Sutra every morning here at the Zen Center. And the Heart Sutra, probably many people have heard, but it has these many beautiful lines like, all dharmas, all phenomena, all things are marked or characterized by emptiness, ungraspability. They neither arise nor cease, are neither defiled nor pure, neither increase nor decrease. So that's Maha Prajna Paramita. We take refuge in this Dharma. The Dharma where all things neither arise nor cease. Nothing ever arises or ceases. No thing, no phenomena. And we can taste this in a kind of ordinary experience of just being presently aware and stepping back from engagement and refuge in all the external objects and looking, asking, what is actually aware of my experience right now? Every moment we're having an experience, what is aware of this experience? We almost never step back to ask. But when we do, we can't define what it is that's aware of this experience and this experience. This experience of sound, color, smell, taste, physical sensations, thoughts, feelings, emotions, happiness, sadness, all of these impermanent, unreliable, empty phenomena are experienced by this awareness that doesn't seem to be coming and going. It's not quite that this awareness is like witnessing these objects and phenomena. That might be a first step that we might come to when stepping back and looking this way. But when we examine more closely, if we try to find a meeting place between the awareness and the colors and sounds and thoughts and emotions and physical feelings, we actually can't find such a meeting place. This awareness seems to be boundless and ungraspable, and therefore all these phenomena that we call experience seem to be like expressions of it, manifestations of it, literally made of this awareness. Of course, course, they're not actually made of anything, because awareness is not something. But in our actual experience, when we look for something outside of this awareness, we can't find. Therefore, all these phenomena actually don't really arise or cease as phenomena, as things, as experiences. And they're not defiled or pure, and they don't increase or decrease. We take refuge in this Dharma, in this teaching, and we can clarify it from many different angles, because it's extremely subtle. You could say extremely obvious and straightforward. We're actually in this Dharma right now, always, unescapably, and yet extremely subtle, because we're very gross creatures that are very engaged in like objects of experience rather than their source. And then the Heart Sutra also says, a bodhisattva relies on this prajnaparamita, this wisdom beyond wisdom, and thus the mind is without hindrance. And without hindrance, there's no fear. So, this is the Sangha. The Sangha is the bodhisattvas that rely on great perfect wisdom, where no thing arises or ceases, increases or decreases. So in our chant we say, all honored ones, bodhisattva, mahasattvas, the noble sangha on the path of prajnaparamita that relies on the dharma of prajnaparamita, on the path to being Buddha throughout the 10 directions and 3 times. All Buddhas, 10 directions, 3 times, I take refuge in boundless, timeless awareness itself. All honored ones, bodhisattva, mahasattvas, I take refuge in those who throw their lives into taking refuge in this Buddha. Wisdom beyond wisdom, maha prajna paramita. I take refuge in totally ungraspable, perfect wisdom beyond all ideas of wisdom. That which bodhisattvas rely on, and Buddhas also, as the Heart Sutra says, all Buddhas of past, present, and future in the 3 times rely also on prajnaparamita, and thereby attain unsurpassed, complete, perfect enlightenment. So these are our ultimate refuges. Dogen, in the essay we're studying about taking refuge in the 3 treasures, Dogen says, the Buddhas and ancestors' authentic transmission, which is a big theme for Dogen, his lineage of the Buddhas and ancestors' authentic transmission is kind of like the central issue for Dogen, and defining what that is over and over again from many angles. But in this essay, the Buddhas and ancestors' authentic transmission through India and China and Japan and America is devotion to Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha. Without taking refuge in them, or returning to and relying on Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha, there is no devotion. Without devotion, there's no taking refuge. the merit and virtue of taking refuge in Buddha, Dharma, Sangha arises through sympathetic resonance. It's the Japanese term kano doko, mystical communion between sentient beings and Buddhas. So it's interesting that he doesn't say, so therefore you, the sentient being now, must take refuge in Buddha. It doesn't actually work that way. And I can't say, well, why don't you just wait for Buddha to give you this refuge? It doesn't work that way either. It's a sympathetic resonance between you and me, the sentient beings, and Buddha, all Buddhas, 10 directions, 3 times. This, when we put forth some spirit of devotion, then Buddha comes and, in a way, gives us refuge. So we take refuge, we go for refuge, and Buddha gives us refuge. That's how taking refuge happens, according to Dogen, in this mystical communion or sympathetic resonance. Or I recently found a translation by Suzuki Roshi of Kano Doko. He calls it responsive communion, or mutual communion. That's kind of nice too. And then Dogen goes on, whether we're in a like heavenly, celestial, very comfy realm, a human realm like this, a hell realm, totally miserable, a hungry spirit realm, or an animal realm, all possible realms of sentient beings, when there is this sympathetic resonance, this responsive communion with Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha, there is inevitably taking refuge in them. So, this theme of Kano Doko, sympathetic resonance, Katagiri Roshi, one of our modern Zen teachers, talks about that in Returning to Silence here. He says, ritual in Buddhism is attaining Kano Doko, which means, he calls it, the interacting communion of appeal and response. Ritual is constantly painting a portrait of our life, setting in motion this interactive communion between us and the universe. He's talking about Buddha here as like the 10 directions. And I think it's an interesting point. Do we say that the totality of everything, the universe itself, is actually awakened awareness? They sound kind of different, but I think on experiential examination, when we look for a universe, it seems throughout space and time, as far as the mind can reach, we find it's all, again, made of boundless awareness of everyone. The one boundless awareness we all share. So then Katagiri Roshi writes this beautiful poem that, if you've read this book, you might remember this poem. I think it's just a beautiful expression of Kano Doko, which is what he's trying to express here, and taking refuge in Buddha, how it works, how we devotedly take refuge in. Here he says ritual. We could say the ritual is to actually recite, I take refuge in Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha. But any sort of ritual activity ideally is invoking Buddha in the way that this poem describes. It's called To Paint the Portrait of a Bird by Jacques Prévert, and translated by Lawrence Ferlinghetti from the French. The poem goes like this. First, paint a cage with an open door. This is called To Paint the Portrait of a Bird. First, paint a cage with an open door. Then paint something pretty, something simple, something beautiful, something useful, for the bird. Then place the canvas against a tree, in a garden, in a wood, or in a forest. Hide behind the tree without speaking, without moving. You get a sense so far for this? You paint the picture, something beautiful for the bird, and you hide behind the tree and don't move or speak. Sometimes the bird comes quickly, but you may take long years before deciding. Don't get discouraged. Wait. Wait years if necessary. How fast or how slowly the bird comes has nothing to do with the success of the picture. When the bird comes, if he comes, observe the most profound silence till the bird enters the cage. And when she's entered, gently close the door with a brush. Then erase all the bars one by one, taking care not to touch any of the bird's feathers. Then paint the portrait of the tree, choosing the most beautiful of its branches for the bird. Paint also the green foliage and the wind's freshness, the dust of the sun, and the noise of the creatures in the grass in the summer heat. And then wait for the bird to decide to sing. If the bird doesn't sing, it's a bad sign. It's a little bit harsh. A sign that the painting's not so good. But if she sings, it's a good sign, a sign that you can sign. So then, very gently, you pull out one of the bird's feathers and you write your name in a corner of the picture. Sweet poem, huh? And we might say, if the bird doesn't sing, we're not at all discouraged by that. We just paint another cage. And again, wait very quietly, hidden behind the tree, because the bird may be scared of people like us, coarse sentient beings like us, if we're too noisy and squirmy. The bird might not just settle right there. So that's an expression of kanodoko. We have to do this work of painting the cage and resting very quietly. And even after the birds enter, we haven't finished. We have to very carefully erase the bars without ruffling the feathers of the bird in the process, which will just fly away. Jacques Prévert, and translated by Lawrence Ferlinghetti, one of the Beat poets. So it seems like we need some method, like cage painting, and we need wisdom. In the Mahayana, they say that's how you make Buddha, is this completion of methods and merit gathered, and the completion of wisdom, which is wisdom beyond wisdom, not something that we actually do. So we need to do something, but we need to understand. So like a daily practice of zazen is a great method, a great cage painting, great way to attract birds. But just to, you know, plunk the body on a cushion is pretty good, but it's only half of the story. We need the completion of wisdom. Some might say, well, just sitting there, wisdom will arrive. But I think we need to clarify again and again what this sitting is. And we can help each other. There's been people practicing a long time this path, so we can discuss it with each other, we can ask each other, we can investigate. We have incredible resources of the Dharma treasure in our midst, a library full of pointers to reality. Did the Buddhas and ancestors who spoke and wrote all those words just do so for their own entertainment? Maybe. I think they did it for us. And then this incredibly subtle Dharma can just collect dust, because we often don't have time. We're taking refuge in things and various kinds of insurance policies and relationships and entertainment and all the things we love, which again I would say are not a problem in and of themselves. It's just that if we think that they are the supreme security, we'll be disappointed inevitably. Like, that we can depend on that disappointment. One thing though that I have been reflecting on personally over the last weeks, I don't know how it came up, but it came to me that basically any activity, it seems to me that like any activity that we do, maybe except like I think we could find some exceptions, like when we're actually really harming others or harming ourselves, it would go outside of this. But most any activity that we do in a daily basis can either be a distraction from taking refuge in Buddha, or a kind of like adornment, an expression of taking refuge in Buddha. It's not really actually about the activity. It's about seeing the nature of the activity, understanding it, paying attention. For example, you know, even something like watching a really like bad TV series for the fifth time, we've already seen it, you know, something like this, like has no redeeming value, no inspiring themes. It's just like pure entertainment. And usually we would say that's like not taking refuge in reality. But even that, I'd say if it's maybe hard, which is why we maybe generally set aside times where we don't get too pulled away by that. But if we're able to, again, ask at the very time of watching this show, what is it that's aware of this bad show? there's the event happening. We're usually engaged, again, in the experience, but who is this experience happening to, or what is aware of this experience? And looking carefully, experientially, again and again, we just find empty space, but aware empty space, with no edges or boundaries, and the space doesn't seem to be coming and going, while the show comes and goes. So, possible to take refuge in the middle of virtually any activity. I say there's these exceptions where we're really harming someone else. I think if we step back at that time and say, who's aware of like punching this person in the face? We can't do it. We can't harm them, I don't think. Or we just, it fizzles away and stops. Granted, there's maybe some gray areas that, and those maybe are our edge of where can we take refuge for the benefit of all beings, without getting distracted by thinking that the event is outside of awareness. it might be a little bit hard to open to this way that all experiences and things and colors and sounds and emotions and thoughts and the human body of sensation as we know it, that all of this, it might sound a little bit strange to say it's made of awareness, but when we look from the perspective of awareness, then it's hard to see it any other way, actually. But looking at it not from the perspective of awareness, but from our usual perspective of even like me kind of witnessing things, even that, well, there's things I'm witnessing. There's somebody witnessing them. We have to go deeper, further back, and investigate the qualities and dimensions of this ever-present awareness. First, we have to see that it actually has no edges or boundary or center. I think until we discern that, which is possible to do any moment, then it doesn't really make sense that things are made out of it. But if we do discern that it has no center, boundary, or edges, then everything experienced must be made of it by its very definition, experientially, as awareness. If something fills the 10 directions in 3 times, nothing is outside of it. Nothing touches it. Nothing meets it. So this is the kind of investigation we can do. Yes, Richard. Dokast.
So, who or what is putting forth this devotion?
Seems that in terms of the this Kano Doko story of sympathetic communion, that it's like the small, the illusory, small, limited self that I think I am, that we all go about the day feeling as if we are an individual person. I think it's that one that puts forth the effort, and we say, well, if that's an illusory one, which we come to see in the end, Buddha reveals to us that one is a kind of mirage, like a very, very convincing, dreamlike appearance of not just visual appearance, but a whole five sense experience. With that one, the illusory one puts forth the effort, and we might say, well, how could an illusory one even put forth effort? We say, well, actually, the illusory one must also be truly, actually made of emptiness, made of 10 direction, 3 time Buddha awareness. So really, it's actually Buddha, meeting Buddha, we could say. But from our point of view, it seems like I don't know about this Buddha business, but I, just me, the little individual self, I express devotion, I open myself to Buddha. Then Buddha meets and reveals to me that actually the one that I thought made the effort was not really the one who made the effort. Something like that. Could you follow that?
I don't follow it in terms of it having a proof. In other words, it's like if we accept there is no self, then there is no thing or self to take refuge or to express devotion. It's almost as if that's just another illusion, those words, but they're useful for living.
That's why why some people, instead of just saying no self, they call another name for no independent, separate small self. Another name for that is boundless awareness, all Buddhas, 10 directions, 3 times. So that's kind of definitely not nothing. No self can sound like there's nothing there to do it. But if we put it in this positive twist on it, and you know, some people in the Buddhist tradition don't like those positive twists because they feel like it gives something to grasp onto. But as long as if we examine this awareness clearly, there is definitely nothing to grasp onto there. I mean, the words about it we can maybe grasp onto, but it's completely empty, but it's radiantly aware at the same time. So that, and not only is it empty and radiantly aware, but it expresses itself as the whole world of people and things and experiences and happiness and sadness, samsara and nirvana. All of it is just this pure display of this inconceivable awareness. Just one way of talking. And I could say that, that is what takes refuge in Buddha. But it appears like that is just this little separate me. It appears like I'm doing it. But what we mean by I is either no self, really, but we can also speak of no self as boundless, empty, clear, knowing presence. Presence is quite different from no self. It's not really different, but it sounds different. When there's no self, obviously there's still presence until we're, you know, gouged out our brain or something.
No self means no refuge.
What do you mean by that?
I think we have to go a step beyond. We have to put the idea of refuge almost into a place of and devotion to the same world as the world of belief, of myth, of how we live, but not into the world of absolute, which we know nothing about.
You could say we don't know anything about the absolute in some graspable way, but we, from this awareness perspective, we call Buddha nature, we are knowing it in this way all the time. We are actually like coursing through ultimate reality. It's not like some place far away or something that we'll realize at some other time. It will always be like this, in the sense of present, open awareness. It's just that right now, that present open awareness is like, is projecting itself into all these like, seemingly external things that cause like all kinds of pain and distress. And we're trying to take refuge in them. That's a basic problem. It's kind of strange. It's like we're taking refuge in ourself, the selfless self, our true self, our true home, who we actually are beyond all graspable definitions, which we sometimes call all Buddhas, 10 directions, 3 times. All directions is one direction, Dogen says, called here. Dogen actually says to, what did he say? Called. This 10 directions are one direction, this direction, self direction. So the 10 directions are this self, but not like some self that we, separate self we think we are, our true self. Present direction, or we might translate it as presence direction. Buddha, we take refuge. And yes?
Could you please say a little more about Kadagiri Roshi's sense of the Prema poem as perhaps an illustration of coming into this sympathetic resonance.
Yeah. Do you know that poem in French? Was it a good translation?
Yes. Very good.
What, like why he chose that, or?
Yes, how Katagiri Roshi sees it as an illustration or a teaching for us to enter into Kamiya Dukkha.
Yeah, the sympathetic response between sentient beings who make this effort and devotion and practice, and then how Buddha meets that. What was your sense of it, Didi?
Oh, I was just curious about how Katagiri Roshi read it. As a set of instructions, as a teaching.
Yeah, I think it sounds to me like it's a beautiful, even Zazen instruction. I think we could hear that poem as Zazen instruction. Mm-hmm. As we do this, this kind of like effortful work of painting this cage. We have to do it with our hands, the appearance, dreamlike appearance of a paintbrush in hands. And it's kind of a nice image too, because we're making a painting, which is not really something anyway. It's a painting of something. But we make that painting, and then we, the maker, you could say the painting is, part of the painting is to take an upright posture, comfortable and relaxed, and pay attention and let go of thoughts of past and future, and start settling into the present. That's I would say that's our basic painting style, but that's not the whole thing. We don't say that's Buddha yet. I would say then we, the painter who made this present intention and posture, then I have to like hide behind a tree, or it's like myself that made it has to not say like, well, now it's going to happen, come on bird. We have to get very quiet and wait, and then maybe the bird will come. It was a little bit like I think a danger in our Soto Zen style. One danger of it is that this poem maybe expresses this danger a little bit of like, we just sit there very quietly, and if we just sit there quietly enough, the bird will come, and it, as the poem said, it might take many years, and it might not come at all. Right? So I think this danger is, that would be like the method without the wisdom. Again, we need these two sides. You might say, isn't that the wisdom? Sitting totally present? Isn't that Prajnaparamita? Very close, I would say. But I think we need to understand. Actually, we need to clarify and understand the subtlety of the Buddha, that the Buddha bird, that actually isn't really flying from somewhere else, right, to enter this cage. The Buddha's, we first start painting the cage, the Buddha's art, the bird Buddha is already there. But again, if we're sort of waiting for something to happen, that's maybe a danger, right? No thing is going to happen. But if we can look clearly, see clearly, with the aid of many teachings, look carefully, like Zen teacher Linji said, there's this true person of no position that's constantly moving in and out through the portals of our face. But if we haven't seen this true person, look, he says, look. And the look, we're so used to looking out there, right? This is the backward look. What one teacher says is like our looking is like this, and we just very gently, from behind the tree, just turn back very gently. It's not back there either, but it's a subtle looking, and that's, I would say, And then what we see from looking is our prajnaparamita. It's not just being present. That's, I think, sometimes Soto Zen gets the rap of, if you're just present and not dwelling in the past and the future and relaxed and your mind is quite still, that's Buddha. In a way, we could say Buddha is there, but in terms of Buddhist meditation, that's just like calm abiding. It's excellent practice, but it's not a prajnaparamita. Yes?
The phrase comes to mind, just this, from birth to death. I think that's what we're talking about. And it's the answer to a question, but I forget what the question was.
Maybe it doesn't matter.
You know what I'm talking about?
Because it's just this, from birth to death. But what is this?
I don't know what they were...
For you.
What?
For you. What is this?
Is this what's happening right now that I'm mostly not noticing, especially when I try to describe it? It goes away.
Yeah, maybe even to
what
say...
What is this? I don't... You know, we're not looking for something else.
Yeah.
Let's stop looking for something else. It's just this.
And not even really what's happening, because that's like, what's happening is what's arising and ceasing, right? And the Heart Sutra says, actually nothing is arising and ceasing. So it does not arise or cease, is unborn, undying, and, has no center or edges.
Don't look for something else.
Yeah, don't look for something else.
Yeah, it's just this.
But also, it's not the experiences we're having. We could say, I think this is the danger in our tradition. We say, just experiencing what's happening, just as it is, without adding anything extra or subtracting anything, that's it. And I would say, that's very close, but my understanding currently is, that's just what's happening. That's what's coming and going. That's an experience. There's something actually that's not happening, but is radiantly aware. You say, isn't that a happening? Not really.
I think the question was, how do you teach prajnaparamita to someone who doesn't understand?
Yeah, the Buddha tried in many ways. First he refused, actually. He said, this is way too hard to teach, actually. And the celestial being said, please, just give it a shot. And he tried, and probably, most people actually don't get it. But then we can keep hearing it again and again. That's why we can chant the Heart Sutra every day. Keep hearing it again and again. Keep making offerings to wisdom beyond wisdom. Keep devotedly bowing to wisdom beyond wisdom. Keep opening ourselves with this like open-hearted devotion, because it's not some intellectual thing. It's not like in the words. The meaning's not in the words, but the words. But it's not without speech. We say it too, right? It's expressed through words. The words are adornment of boundless space, like awareness. So, and for a beginner, we could say, how do we get it? Then I think it's just devotion. It's just reciting the Heart Sutra over and over. And then, and the method is so important, I think. If people can keep a daily practice of sitting upright, present and relaxed, and letting go of all the stories and stuff that's happening, that's priceless. Such a gift. I don't think we're going to realize prajnaparamita without that. Maybe even sitting one period a day, it might be hard to fully open to this. Although, again, it's not limited to any particular method. We might get it when we're driving down the highway, right? So, There's no special way. Mm-hmm. The Buddhas have infinite skillful means. Yes?
I wonder, I think I heard my question in there, which is, I'm having trouble with the difference between consciousness and awareness.
Yeah. The Buddhist tradition these are English words, but usually we say consciousness is vijnana, is dualistic knowing. Literally, vijnana means dualistic knowing, divided knowing. So it's the way we're usually, like, and we could even say, that's like the witness. Some people say, just being the witness, isn't that prajnaparamita? The witness is witnessing objects, right? We have to actually come, it's a good step, but we have to get to this point where actually the objects cannot be separate from the awareness. And that's called jnana, which is sometimes translated as awareness. So consciousness has a subject and object. Awareness, the way I use these terms, is undivided knowing, where there's no subject and object, there's no self or other. And the only way that we can break that duality, I don't think we can like put the mind into the things. I think we need to put the things into the awareness. We have to break the duality. If somebody has a better way than of saying this, then the things must be made of awareness. Then let me know. I mean, there are other ways, I think, like saying they're all completely empty is another way. But I think it's more kind of, that's a little philosophical sounding or something. This is very, we can taste this experience. It's not that hard to first explore the awareness to make sure that it actually has no edges or boundaries just by looking for them and being sure we're not going to find them anywhere. And a center, we're not going to find it. That's actually harder because it feels like the center is around here. But if you keep examining awareness, the center is not here. It has no center.
How do I examine awareness without a divided mind?
That's a great question. Yeah, it has to be awareness is exploring itself. Yeah. Yeah, which in fact it always is. In fact, the divided mind, by definition too, must be made of awareness. Consciousness, dualistic consciousness, must be another adornment or manifestation or expression of non-dual awareness. The illusion of consciousness is another mirage, actually, in terms of awareness. And actually the teachings, Mahayana does teach this way. It's called like transformation of the base. The base consciousness. The defiled storehouse of delusion. Defiled only by the belief in duality. Is overturned, transformed, or more experientially we could say, is revealed to actually not be a consciousness. It never was, never will be. There's no such thing as a laya vijnana. And that's called, in the ancient teachings, called the great perfect mirror awareness. It's the true nature of the storehouse consciousness. Pretty cool, people trying to put these things into words. It's time to go. Let me just leave you with an expression of the three treasures from Asanga, our ancient Indian friend from the 4th century, the founder of the Yogacara school. And this is a text called the Ratna Gotra Vibhaga, or the distinguishing or clearly discerning the precious source, we might translate it as the precious nature, the Ratna Gotra. Buddha, his expression of Buddha is, I bow down to the beginningless, centerless, and infinite to perfect peace, Buddha, fully self-awakened and self-blossomed by itself, which once purified and developed shows the fearless, unchanging path to bring realization to those with no realization, and which wielding the supreme sword and vajra of knowledge and compassionate love cuts down the seedlings of suffering and destroys the walls of doubt surrounded by the dense forest of mistaken views. Dharma. I bow down to the radiant sun of Dharma, which is neither existent nor non-existent, nor a combination of existence and non-existence, nor something other than existence or non-existence. The ungraspable, beyond all verbal definition, self-aware, peace, stainless, brilliant with the night, with the light of knowing, jnana, which completely destroys grasping for, aversion towards, or dullness towards mental objects. Whew. I bow down to the Sangha, those whose mind is no longer obscured, the deeply realized who have knowings or awarenesses, perception, again it's this word jnana, awareness of the total purity present in limitless beings. As the true nature of mind is lucid clarity, they see all defilements and, you know, greed, hate, and delusion to be without essence, and hence truly realize ultimate no-self, peace within all beings. Thus they know the all-pervading presence of perfect Buddhahood in each and every sentient being. That's the Sangha. I'd say that's a highfalutin Sangha. But as the supreme refuge, the totally reliable refuge, we could say we take refuge in the community of practitioners that we practice with, but how about like in their true nature, which is actually all their crazy expressions are made of their true nature. So if we're careful with this, we can even take refuge in all the kind of like annoying qualities of beings too, because the annoying qualities are actually made of their Buddha nature. I mean, and how could they not be? So I take refuge in Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha. Although I confess, I am constantly distracted from this Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha. So this is a pep talk to myself. And you can take it or leave it as you wish. I'm constantly distracted, meaning just that I believe the appearances, I forget that the appearances are not made of Buddha nature. I vow to remember, and I trust that they are. That's I'm extremely happy to at least trust that they are, even though I'm constantly forgetting. So we dedicate this merit to all beings everywhere. May they all be devoted to Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha in whatever religion or spiritual tradition or non-spiritual tradition they might be coursing in. May they open to true, ungraspable nature and be free from all suffering. Beings are numberless. I vow to save them. Delusions are inexhaustible. I vow to end them. Dharma gates are boundless. I vow to enter them. Buddha's ways unsurpassable. I vow to become it.